The Christina Borgeson Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hi, I'm having a fascinating but disturbing conversation with investigative reporter Freddy Ponton about bioweapons labs in the Ukraine and the bigger agenda here. I just, you know, I was, before I came on today, I did a little research and I was looking at this 2001 interview that PBS's Nova did with Bill Patrick. And one of the questions that they had asked him was, you know, what do you think about this new technology using recombinant DNA for biological warfare? And he was talking about through DNA technology, you can improve the stability of the virus that you're trying to use to infect people. You could reduce the number of cells required for infection by the respiratory route. And he said, and instead of killing 1 million people at a strike, you could probably now kill 10 million with an improved biowarfare agent through genetic engineering. You know, so they were thinking about all this stuff way back.
It's look, you know, it's, as I said, you know, there's different school in understanding or interpreting what you're listening here. And as I said, is that I've looked at a different way of looking at this entire research program, bioweapon research. You know, there's nothing new here. This has been going on for a long period of time, and they've tried a lot of things. You know, they a lot of containment of these extremely dangerous pathogens. You know, some of them stay on the Ukrainian ground, but some of them are, as I said, transported back to the United States, to Germany. There's an island called the Rims Island in the Baltic part of Germany on the coast, where they have basically the FLI, the Friedrich Laufer Institute, which is probably the oldest BSL-free lab in Europe. And they have been basically partnering heavily with Ukraine. What they're doing basically is bioforensic. They pick up all these pathogens, these very, very weird viruses or animals. And then what they do is they conduct any kind of experiments. And obviously, if there is some highly dangerous research, they're going to want to do that in BCL3, BSL4 laboratories. So they are basically doing something. They are, I mean, the conversation around game of functions and the ability to make a virus more dangerous and giving him some properties as far as spraying the virus and aerosol capabilities, all that has been understood. But yet again, as I said, we're dealing with intelligence, military intelligence. We're dealing with an intelligence program and people that have been working 20 years on that. So clearly, if they're going to put a program out there, they're going to have a strategy as far as the communication. And the perhaps person that described it well is the WHO. They always talk about pandemic and infodemic. It's about basically being aware that a lot of people are going to challenge there. A lot of information is going to be confusing. And they're going to thrive on that, because more there is information out there, and less you're going to get closer to the truth. So as I said, you got to take, and more importantly, rely on what you know. And what we know is that these guys, especially the intelligence community, is always about deception. It's always about putting out a message that's going to lead people in one direction when the real business is taking care on the other side of the question. So that's the way I'm looking at it. I've been working via my work, my professional career. I've had the chance to entertain a lot of government relations and been able to be confronted with certain intelligence agencies or people that I work along down those lines. And there is definitely, the deception is really a part of what these people do, you know. So you need to understand what they do, what you see, and follow the money. That's really something you can rely upon, and you can definitely rely upon these people to lead you in the wrong direction, so you don't look actually at what matters. And what matters here is the dangerosity, the capability that a message has to be deterrent, to be able to create a threat at the border of Russia, not far you know, Russia has a border with China, I believe. So there is also the possibility of creating that fear, the constant fear of threat around the world. Look at the United States authorities. Okay, we got 30 labs in Ukraine. They got about 300 labs around the world. So we're talking about, again, a small, it's happening in Ukraine. We got obviously Russia and Ukraine. That obviously creates a lot of data. That's created a lot of interest from the populations. And
You have a lot of bombs falling in Ukraine too. You know, and what I mean, what happens? What happens if they have level 3 labs? So what happens if something? If a bomb hits one of those labs, maybe that's a stupid question. Maybe they have safety precautions for that or whatever. I don't know. But, you know, I'm thinking about, obviously, these elites, okay, who are overlording this whole process, okay, they are like a breakaway civilization. That's how they've been described. And I fully agree with that. That's what they are. But for the rest of us, because the rest of us could become the targets at any time. You know, at some point they're going to be able to target, I would think, individuals with bioweapons, you know. I don't know, but it certainly seems like something that they would probably work on. And what about us? What about us in all this? How do we address this?
The way to address it is really to go back to the power that people have, which is basically to force their government for transparency, and more importantly, via the democratic process, to be able to put people in place that have a critical view about what's going on. You know, this is obviously out of the hands of many people, even in our government. We need to understand that.
Wait a second, Freddie, let me ask you something. You're French. There was just a French election. Macron, with a 38% approval rating, won the election again. Do you really think there was a democratic process going on there?
There is not a democratic process, Christina. It is just, there is two aspects of it. One is that there doesn't exist an elections to die for the past 20 years. There's always room for cheating. It's happening any single election. So it's not specific to France or to the United States.
No, we have the same issue over here.
It happens. So it's like, That is something that you take for granted. You know that there's going to be some cheating of one form or the other. So that you can take it for granted. But we are suffering from really, as I said, in France and many other countries in Europe, of ignorance. You know, this is the biggest virus that you can have, where people are ill-informed or not interested even to be informed, and they're going to choose a candidate based on the fact that the other one is probably politically not correct for you to vote for. So there is this kind of a real weird scenario where people find themselves, as you said, voting for the plague instead of voting for the cholera. And that's not a choice. Is this something, is it a coincidence, or was it actually orchestrated that way so that you have the impression of a choice, but you don't have actually any choice? My view on this is that this was orchestrated from day one. It is absolutely no doubt in my mind that there is conversation and discussions taking place from the Le Pen party and Macron's party, and there is definitely some kind of negotiations that's taking place. Now, one thing that is interesting to understand, Christina, is also the process as far as who govern the countries. The Prime Minister of France is the head of the government. So what's important is the representations in the parliament. You need to have a strong majority in the parliament to govern. Otherwise, you're just a puppet president that's going to go and shake hands around the world and using private jets and spending taxpayers' money. So the real government is based on the legislative elections that are coming up in June. So if you ask me this question again after the legislative elections, and if I see that indeed Marine Le Pen is going to take control with the various coalitions and negotiations she's going to do with other parties and actually govern, then we're going to be able to see if we can change that. If we don't see any change at the legislative, and if we don't see any change during the mandate of Le Pen-led governments, then we know this is completely globally orchestrated and we've lost the democratic process. So we lost a lot already, our liberties, our freedom, and they've used the pandemic to take that away from us. So definitely they've weaponized the One Health agenda, being able to basically control, because this is probably the way I'm going to conclude this conversation, but the overall aim of these globalists is purely basically keeping control of the populations. They've been focused for 50 years on securing natural resources, and they've been for the last past probably 10 years focusing on controlling the human resources. We're going to be a problem they're going to have to manage, and that's going to be a national security threat. That's going to be a big problem on their hand. So there's the social components in this program, and they need to really address it. So more control they have, more ability you're going to have to fight. And that's going to take, you know, different ways, different approach. And politically speaking, the government is going to be less and less powerful because it has chosen the private partnership model. So you're going to see basically people placing the government to enforce the digital transformation that's going to give the European Union and the United Nations far more control that they deserve. And that's going to be take away any aspect of any way for the people of every day to defend themselves, because all the apparatus that are there to protect you, for example, the Constitution in the United States, the Bill of Rights, all that's going to be taken away from you in the way they're going to basically set up this new economic, this new government, this new world government. And that's extremely worrying, very troubling time. But there is hope. If people wake up, if people fight, and if we expose them, we have a chance. But we must be relentless. And that will be my advice to anybody. Keep fighting.
I want to just get back to one thing. How, if you're, you know, talking about the dual use, how could you ever prove, what kind of investigation do you do to prove that dual use is not only is existent in these labs? I mean, obviously, biosecurity, that's one thing, but developing a bioweapon, how do you figure that out?
Well, it's, as I said, you know, it's going to be extremely hard, and the only chance we have to get some information from inside is the ability for instance the Russians to be able to get their hand on some research. But what I can tell you already is that they have pretty much everything. I know very well Russians in their cultures and in their mentality. I've had a chance to spend time with Russians, so I understand how they think. And I believe that when they come to the United Nations Security Council saying you need to look into that, something is going on and it's extremely dangerous. That is a threat not only for Russian borders, but the entire region, if not Europe and the world at large. So they have pretty much already all the information. I don't think they need to. They don't need to get more information. These are chess players. They're gonna have pretty much all the cards. They just haven't put them on the table yet. Depending on what kind of response they're gonna get from the NATO allies and the United States, so they keep obviously some of the information in case Germany or France decide to do something stupid. They're gonna have some of cards to play. You see, Christina, the impact of proliferations on biosecurity is very obvious. It's global. It's not only Ukraine. It's a global phenomenon.
Yes, and of course.
There is obviously the real danger from a real pragmatic way is the conduct of high containment infection diseases research. That requires a lot of things: commitment, fundings, training, education, infrastructures, maintenance, and then obviously ethic. Now, ethic has disappeared from the equation, that you can be sure of it. And then you need now to look
at... Yeah, replaced by pathology, Earth. I'd say. You know, yes. Psychopathology.
The question, Christina, is why on Earth, right, the numbers of facilities supporting this research are placed in a volatile country such as Ukraine, Ukraine has been volatile. This is the paradise for corruptions. I mean, they could write, you know, theses, and, you know, many people have PhDs on corruption in this country. So the likelihood of release to the public and environments is increasing. If you're increasing the numbers of biosecurity labs and bio labs facilities around the world, what you also increase is basically the release and the likelihood of release of this pathogen within the public and the environment. So that's what I believe, is that this is becoming a Cold War weapon, where you say, I've got these pathogens, extremely dangerous. I found a way to basically release them into animals, into the agriculture, into the populations. And that is, you know, a huge threat for any nations around the world. So this is weaponizing, basically. This is what the bioweapons become. It's the ability to say to people, we have the way to do it, we have the means, we know how to do it, and more importantly, we have developed vaccines and countermeasures that allowed us to protect not only our population, but also our militaries as well. So this is what it's all about. It's a mind war, and as I say, it's a germ war. It's not a war games anymore.
I understand the power of the threat. I understand that. But, you know, we're talking about a country. Certainly, when you talk about the United States, you're talking about a country that was willing to, because how else could highly aerosolized, weaponized anthrax be released, okay, and kill people in the United States, unless it came directly from a military facility? Nobody wants to look at that. They created the Patsy with Bruce Ivins, you know, from USAMRID, but there's just handling that required a special facility. So this is the United States. They did that in 2001, okay? And it's military connected for sure. Okay, so now this is in the Ukraine. The Germans, of course, we know what the Germans are capable of. That's even, you know, back then, we know what they're capable of, you know. So it's, to me, it's a very real threat. I totally understand Russia, you know, the United States dropped the nuclear bomb. The United States is willing to do things that nobody else would think of doing. I mean, that's the history. If you have to look at the history. And you know, and I'm not talking about the people, obviously. The people don't make these pathological decisions, okay? So if you have a breakaway civilization that thinks, look, as long as we live and we can protect ourselves and we have all the resources and everything, the rest of us are cockroaches. We're cockroaches.
Yes, it is that we are cockroaches if we are not strong mentally and psychologically. You know, I'll give you a great example. About a month ago, they lifted all the mask wearing, you know, in supermarkets, in malls and everything in France. So everybody doesn't need to wear a mask any longer. Yet you have a segment of the population that is keep on wearing masks. They're wearing masks jogging I live by the beach. Right? So people are jogging with masks. People are going to shopping with masks. People are driving in their car with masks, you know. Yet the government has given the instruction, say, okay, you don't need to wear a mask. The risk is not enough. It doesn't make any sense anymore to wear it. Well, it never make any sense in the first place anyway, because this mask is not to protect you at all. You know, any surgeon will tell you that in about 2 minutes. But what's important here, I think, is the psychological effect, because it basically is going to last far more longer than if you have actually a year and a half of a pandemic or an endemic situation in the country. That might last a year or two, but the psychological effect of the threat of a biological weapon has far more lasting consequences. So, as I say, I'm not saying that I'm right, because that would be very arrogant of me to do that. But what I'm saying is that I so far looking at the entire programs and the stakeholders, the money, really studying this as a big picture and trying to come up to a conclusion that makes sense according to my research, then I can say that, as I said, the risk of accidental or deliberate release of these experimental pathogens is absolutely real. Now,
yes.
Can we say today it's in the lab, we have them, doing like Powell did at the United Nations and showing the little anthrax and say, look, there's Iraq is bioweapon, let's go and destroy it and kill a million people. Well, we don't have that because we can't today access, this scientific data. But clearly, I think we can say that the capabilities, the abilities for the French government, the United States government and the German government to do that is real. What we need today is to say, okay, how far are we going to be in the blur? How much lack of transparency we are prepared to accept unless we're going to start to put real pressure on our government and ask them really some to be accountable. It's all about accountability. If we don't have it, we don't have democracy, Christina.
Yeah, but we haven't had accountability for any of this stuff, right? I mean, who went to jail? Who went to jail for the anthrax attacks? Nobody. Yeah. They killed off Bruce Ivins, and that was it. Oh, this one guy did this whole operation. I mean, it was just absolutely nuts. And that's the concern. And I think that I think another aspect to this is people are traumatized. I think that's why people are still wearing their masks, in their cars when they're alone or when they go out jogging. I mean, it's really sad, but I think they're traumatized. And absolutely. And the question is, how do you break through that trauma? And meanwhile, yes, who knows? I mean, every day as we speak right now, something's going on in those, have they shut those labs down during this whole war situation? What's going on with those labs right now? Do you have any idea?
Well, it's clearly, obviously, a battle with time. I think the presence of the Russian troops on the ground has accelerated a lot of things. And as you can see, there's obviously a lot of delegations, a lot of officials, a lot of intelligence personnel from the United States, certainly from Germany and the European Union, were in Ukraine. And some of them probably got stranded in Ukraine. That's my view on it. I think that we have some intel personnel in Ukraine that is stranded, probably in these in this factory by the river, Asvald factory, and they're definitely kind of trying to move away this personal, but also moving these dangerous pathogens out of the labs in which the research were conducted. So there's definitely been a war against time for those involved in this research and this program. And but I think, as I say to you, I don't think it matters anymore. I believe the Russians pretty much have it all. And they are trying to make everybody understand, especially their partners, whether it's, European partners or the United States, trying to explain to them that they have it pretty much all. They knew what's going on there. And they are telling it, we're not prepared to entertain you conducting this research at our borders. We're not prepared to accept for Ukraine to become a NATO partner. And that's the bottom line. And unless they are prepared and they want to return to peace, nothing's going to happen. And we will see this conflict with the Russians taking control of Ukraine. Absolutely no doubt about that. Otherwise, it's going to be an open war. And I don't think anybody wants to have an open war with a company with so much nuclear capabilities. So I think it's going to be the only way this can be resolved is with a diplomatic, going back to the diplomatic table and trying to go back to the Minsk agreements, trying to stabilize these countries and rebuild these countries. I think that's what these countries and most importantly, the Ukrainian people needs. I'm not taking any stance as far as the Ukrainian and the Russian. What matters is that people are suffering. People are suffering on the ground.
Exactly.
People are basically trying to rebuild their life. A lot of people lost their family members. And this is what we should focus on, not about who's right, who's wrong, because I can tell you I can fight wrong and wrong on both sides of the battle, if you will, you know. And it's really a shame that some Ukrainians still believe that the United States and other countries, the EU allies, are working in the best interest of Ukraine. It's not the case, because we know from fact, and I have the intelligence report on that, that the Minsk agreement was derailed, and there's no doubt in my mind that it was about to be implemented and it was derailed. Now, who derailed that? Who has the power to derail at the European Council state leaders level to be able to derail that, to install a new paradigm, a new understanding, and a new basically lobbying campaign about the independence of Ukraine and how important that is, more important than actually the real stability of these countries, which will allow all the partners, the Russians, the German, the French, the anybody's in Europe, the British, and of course the United States, to participate in the economic development in these countries and allowing everybody in Ukraine to be at peace and sort out the Eastern Europe, this Eastern Ukraine conflict, because this cannot be solved without sorting out and accepting the, you know, obviously these Eastern Europe countries as a, some people describe it as a genocide. I don't know if we can say that, but clearly there was a clear ethnic cleansing going on for 8 years in the Donbas region, and that can just not be ignored. You know, some people need to be held accountable, and there's certainly what I would like to see is for the German to do what they should be doing, which is securing their investment in these countries. They've invested billions in these countries that could actually benefit the Ukrainian people, and they should favor the stability rather than to send weapons and tanks and missiles and stuff like that to Ukraine.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, I'll tell you what.
And you're sending weapons to a country, how does that work?
You know? Exactly. You know, I just want to tell you how much I appreciate the work that you do. Please keep it up. Bravo on your previous pieces. Can't wait to see what else you're going to come up with. Thank you so much for coming on, Freddie.
It's my pleasure, Christina. Thank you very much, all the best. Pleasure to be on the show.
TNT Radio's Patrick Henningsen.
Her name is Marwa Osman, and she's also the host of a fantastic show on Press TV, Mideast Stream, one of the best geopolitical and foreign affairs analysts out there regarding the Middle East. Marwa, I was shocked when I saw this announcement. What's happening with this ceasefire right now? Is this the real deal? What can we expect to see?
Well, it's the real deal would be on the table when the siege is lifted, the aerial, the sea, and the land blockade. Once that is lifted, then we can begin talking about a real deal coming from the 7 years of aggression against Yemen, the Saudi-led aggression against Yemen, going into the 8th year since March 25th, since it started in March 25th, 2015. Basically, it was a Saudi approach after the big target that happened last week when the Yemeni armed forces targeted Aramco in Jeddah, and they targeted Tanura, which is the basically the port that has 80% of the Saudi oil exported out of Saudi Arabia. So they targeted those facilities, which damages a lot Saudi economic interests and also affects the actual price of oil worldwide.
Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Every 2 minutes, an American is sexually assaulted. The majority of victims know their attacker. It could be your friend, your neighbor, or someone you met at a party. If you said no, it's rape. And it's a crime. This is Christina Ricci with RAIN. Call the National Sexual Assault Hotline today at 1-800-656-HOPE or visit RAIN.org. That's RAINN.ORG.
Brought to you by RAIN and this station.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
The Christina Borgeson Show on TNT.
So welcome back. My next guest is internal medicine physician and biological warfare epidemiologist, Dr. Meryl Nass. She's consulted for the World Bank, the Government Accountability Office, and the U.S. Director of National Intelligence on Prevention, Investigation, and Mitigation of Chemical and Biological Warfare and Pandemics. She's recently written a very interesting piece titled COVID Persists, but the COVID narrative has taken on so much water, the powers that be have stopped bailing and are going to let these vaccines slowly sink. Hi, Meryl.
Hello, Christina.
Oh, this article gave me some hope. You know, it gave me some hope. Are you having problems hearing me?
No, I'm hearing you fine.
Oh,
I was
okay.
Wondering if you were having difficulties.
No, I can hear you. So in your article, you list a series of events and data that blew the official narrative out of the water. Talk about those.
Oh, what I did, this piece got attention that I wasn't expecting. And I was surprised because so many people have told me it made them feel hopeful. And I guess I didn't realize how many people had a very dark impression of what was going to happen, because I thought it was, you know, fairly dark myself in what I wrote. So I listed the thing. There's been so much information coming out over the last couple of months that the vaccines don't work, that the longer you follow them for, if you've had two shots and you haven't had a booster, after about 6 months, it seems that you're in a group that is more susceptible to getting COVID than if you had never been vaccinated. And that it, and in the 5 to 11-year-olds, the statistics were really terrible. So that after 7 or 8 weeks, the Pfizer vaccine was only 12% effective at preventing COVID. And these I try to really focus on very high quality data. So this was the children's data was from the New York State Department of Health. And so people don't really realize, because they haven't been told, that the states and the CDC have records of every single person who's been vaccinated and when they were vaccinated. And they also have records of every test. And they have high quality data as far as this is concerned, even though they're not usually sharing it. In the case of New York State, they had 365,000 children in a cohort. And most, you know, many of them were vaccinated, and they were able to see, because they had all these tests, what the likelihood was of the unvaccinated versus the vaccinated getting COVID. And they had it on a week by week basis. So you could see as each week went on how the children were more and more likely to get COVID because they had such a large, huge cohort. And if you look at their diagrams, they don't say it in the body of the paper, which is a preprint. The kids actually get into negative territory also, just like the adults. So after 6 to 9 months or so has gone by in the adults, you become more susceptible to COVID. And it looked like the kids were about getting about 10 to 20% more susceptible to COVID after about 8 to 10 weeks. In the adults, the amount of increased susceptibility in some of the data, the UK data, was huge. So they could be more than twice as likely to come down with COVID as, wow, as an unvaxxed person. Although if they had gotten a booster that gave them some additional protection for a few months. It's very interesting, you know, because we don't have any vaccines that work this way, that actually give you some protection. Well, the first 2 weeks, they don't give you protection. And then you start making antibodies, they start to give you protection, and it peaks, you know, around a couple of months, which is when they, you know, the manufacturers test you. And then it starts dropping off. And you know, we don't have any normal vaccines that drop off to more than zero. That, you know, we don't have any regular vaccines that actually, after a period of time, make you more susceptible to the infection than you would have been otherwise. But these do. And, you know, one way this could have gone is the government could have just called for everybody to be vaccinated every 4 months. And, you know, you weren't going to be considered fully vaccinated unless you did that. And you weren't going to be able to keep your job, blah, blah, blah. It could have gone that way. So it, thank God it didn't. Things were, the data were bad enough, and they couldn't keep propping up this story. And however, we still, we still are facing a potential authorization of vaccine for children under the age of five. Right now, you can vaccinate children through the age of five with a Pfizer shot. Moderna has just applied for an emergency use authorization for children down as low as 6 months, and Pfizer has said they're about to. Yeah, so now FDA twice postponed a meeting on the Pfizer data. From what the two companies have told the public, they don't meet the standards that FDA had established at the beginning of the pandemic. So when FDA told manufacturers starting at least in June of 2020, what they would need to be able to show in terms of efficacy to get an EUA.
Well, emergency use authorization. Yeah.
Thanks. They were, remember, we were told at the beginning they were 90 to 95% effective. And then, of course, that wasn't real in the, you know, it's always, you always do better in the clinical trial than in the real world. And so it's way less than that for adults, but for children, even at the 2 month mark, they can barely get 50%. And so they haven't. So Pfizer wasn't able to get. So there's two ways of looking at efficacy. And the way the FDA and the manufacturers have done it up until now is they looked at antibody levels. And they said, look, if these kids, if this particular age group has an antibody level that's the same as in a higher age group, where they actually were able to show in clinical trials there weren't so many cases, once you know that the vaccine actually prevented cases and hopefully prevented serious illness and death, then we're going to be able to take that antibody level and call it good. We're going to say that's adequate evidence for immunity. So that's what they've done. That's what they did for the 12 to 16 year old group. And for the 11 to 5-year-old group, they took these antibody levels. They never got clinical trial evidence that the vaccines worked. And then, so now we have this New York State data. And of course, CDC has data from all the other 49 states, but the people from New York decided they were going to publish, you know, so I guess FDA and CDC could not stop them from publishing this. And the result, in my view, I mean, what happened is that FDA and its advisory committee members, as well as its briefers, have said that actually the antibody levels are not adequate for assessing immunity. So
why are Moderna and Pfizer trying to get approval for these things that de facto, you know, can't meet the standards?
Well, there's a lot of possibilities. You know, FDA is a political organization, and that it's a great interest that only last week the General Accounting Office put out a report saying there's no method for people at FDA, CDC, NIH, and the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness's office. None of these agencies have a method for reporting on political interference. There's nothing for a whistleblower to do. There's nowhere to go. There's nowhere to report.
How convenient.
Yes. And so all these agencies are expected to develop plans for how to do that. But the implication with this GAO report is that, yes, these agencies have had a pressure applied, and a GAO got people to call in anonymously and give their stories, et cetera. So, because these are political agencies, they will do what they're told. And if there's enough pressure put on them, they will cave, FDA will cave, and give an authorization for six-month-old babies to have a shot. They just gave an authorization, it wasn't an authorization, it was actually a license extension for remdesivir down to the age of 28 days. So a newborn baby, not even a month old, can be given remdesivir either as an outpatient or an inpatient. It's an IV drug. They're basing this on one open label clinical trial that had 53 children in it, of whom three died.
So 6% they're gonna kill these kids.
It might kill these kids. We don't know what it's gonna do. And FDA had no business extending the license to babies down to a month, less than a month of age, without data. But this is what they did just about 4 days ago. So the thing is, if they did that, they could certainly go ahead and authorize vaccine for babies. There's no question about even without data. Now you can try to shame them. The Robert Califf is the new commissioner of FDA. He was only put in February. He said he wants data. He claimed he was a big data person, and you know, you can't get approved without data. So we try to shame him on that basis. Children's Health Defense, which is an organization I work with, had already threatened them. So the FDA was going to have an advisory meeting first in February, and then they announced it was going to be postponed till April, and now they've postponed it till June. But at least they've put forward some dates. So it looks like they're serious that they will have an advisory meeting to discuss toddlers and babies vaccines. And that means, you know, a lot could happen in the next 2 months. Obviously, they don't, just because it doesn't meet the standards, this is a problem. You know, when I fought the FDA on the anthrax vaccine didn't meet the standards, and one judge took the license away, but the other side appealed. And when we went back to court with a new judge, the judge said, well, the FDA has deference. So you say it doesn't meet the standards, but FDA gets to decide.
But Meryl, I mean, shouldn't we even go back to a more fundamental thing with all these considerations vaccinating kids, which is these are emergency use authorizations that are given for a concoction that does not meet the statutory definition of vaccine, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it doesn't meet the definition of what you would expect from a vaccine. And had the government not lied and cheated and gone through all sorts of, you know, contortions to try to get rid of ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, chloroquine, mefloquine, etc., the statute says if there is a licensed drug that can do the same thing, you can't give this drug or vaccine an EUA, emergency use authorization. And the thing about both hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin is that they are in widespread use in Africa like vaccines. They are used as preventives for malaria and for river blindness because they both have a very long half-life. So you can take only one dose every so often, like every 6 months or a year for river blindness, or a weekly dose for malaria, and you can prevent those diseases. So they work like vaccines. And had the government acknowledged that they existed and would work against COVID, which they do, it would not have met the statutory standard for any EUAs because they have drugs that work both for treatment and for prevention right there. So, the whole thing stinks. But when the government is the criminal, which is something I mentioned in the article, we don't have a body of law that protects us because the framers, you know, never expected that it would be the people against the government.
So, you know, it's so interesting. I saw that and I was going to point that out. You said you wrote that the law, U.S. law, is not designed for situations in which the government is criminal. And in all my investigations of criminal malfeasance, I've noticed exactly that. There is never an assumption in any of the Title 18 codes or any, you know, the criminal codes, whatever, for government malfeasance. There, it never assumes that the government can be criminal. you know?
Right.
I mean, and well, if, you know, there are, if you lie during a hearing or something, you can be fined and stuff like, but for major, major malfeasance, nada, you know? And, exactly. And so, I don't even know who would you even go to change that, to create a body of laws that says, okay, if the government engages in major malfeasance organized among several, because we're talking more than one agency. I mean, you talked about the CDC, basically, I allegedly, I'll say bribing, but anyway, they got 20 medical professional organizations to recommend vaxes for teens after, you know, a rash, you know, after reports were coming in.
That, right.
Go ahead.
Of myocarditis. Yes. Yeah, So the Israel noticed that they were having a lot of myocarditis after vaccinating people, and they published it. And in this country, there were efforts to keep that hidden. And so it was hidden for a couple of months, and then it leaked out into the open. So then CDC and FDA had, you know, more advisory committee meetings and presented data, and all of it tried to minimize the severity of myocarditis. They pretended nobody's died, and yet there were case reports in the newspapers of teenagers dying from this, you know, diagnosed with myocarditis on autopsy. CDC has said it was a very brief bout, and yet now there's a paper published where they looked at kids 3 to 6 months down the road and found the majority of them continued to have inflammation of the heart on MRI. So another thing CDC primarily did was, but FDA colluded also, was to try to reduce the incidence of myocarditis. So in CDC studies, they tried to say it was about 1 in 20,000. Well, it turned out when Kaiser took so there were two warring Kaiser studies. One is paid for by CDC and one was independent. So the head of vaccine research at Kaiser has been consulting for the CDC for more than 20 years, Nicola Klein. And she gives them whatever they want. But another doctor who worked at a different Kaiser center in Oregon named Katie Scharf was able to also access the data, and she studied it and found there's so many ways to fake, you know, to get the results you want when you're doing medical research. It's sad to say. So yeah. Katie and her group found that Nicola and her group were not using sufficient codes to capture all the myocarditis cases. When you're looking at these large databases, you need to, and you're looking at, say, discharge diagnoses. Well, not everybody had a definite diagnosis of myocarditis, say, at the time they were discharged. Maybe tests were still coming in and that diagnosis was made later. Or perhaps nobody had dictated a discharge summary during the period of time that was studied. Or there are various ways. But when this Oregon Kaiser took those things into account, they got a pretty high rate of myocarditis. In boys after the second shot, aged 18 to 24, 1 in 2,000 had wound up with a diagnosed case of myocarditis. And of course, there are all these people who are dropping dead on the field, and these teenagers who are dying in their sleep are often turning up with myocarditis on autopsy, but they never went to a doctor. They either didn't have chest pain and shortness of breath, or they didn't complain of it, or somebody thought it was something else. So the 1 in 2,000 that turned up in Oregon is certainly, you know, low. It could be 1 in 500. It could be 1 in 200. We just don't know.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Talk about the military database information from the whistleblowers. The military, they're so used and abused. This really sickens me.
Yes. Well, my experience with the anthrax vaccine and Gulf War syndrome revealed that the military takes a very, very utilitarian view of its service members So they're there, most of them, for 3 or 4 years, and then they're gone. And the military is not responsible for what happens to them afterwards. So they can, you know, on Fort Hood, for example, had, you know, a lot of contamination of the water. But that doesn't kill you right away. That just sets you up for diseases down the road. So the military didn't feel like they had to clean it up right away either. There were many different noxious, toxic exposures that soldiers faced and have faced for a long time. And see, they become the VA's problem after that. And if they get sick, if they get injured enough to be really sick, while they can go through a process and try to get disability from the military, almost none get it. Maybe some of the higher officers might get it, but most of them are just discharged with nothing and told to go apply to the VA. And that's a different pot of money. So because the military is really not, you know, there's no incentive for them to take care of the problem of sickening soldiers. So anyway, there's a military database called the Defense Medical Surveillance System, which Congress required the military to establish as a result of Gulf War syndrome and not having data on what the exposures were that soldiers had that may have led to illness. And as you know, it's 30 years later and we still don't have good answers on what the causes or cause of Gulf War syndrome is. But anyway, there is a database now which records every vaccination and every deployment and gives you some idea of the exposures. And it's got every medical visit. So, and a version of this is the DMED system, and several doctor whistleblowers who were seeing patients who were ill as a result of vaccination started to make inquiries of this database and were able to download a lot of information and then share it with a lawyer and with the media and with Senator Ron Johnson and others. And now what happened though, as a result of them downloading it and starting to share it, is the military said, oh, there was a glitch. There was a glitch in the data, and then they redid the data.
Oh, so, wow.
So now it's sort of not clear what the extent of the problem is because of the glitch.
But and I'm sure the glitch was in their favor in terms of victims, right?
Right. Well, right. Well, they tried to make the prior years look worse so that there wasn't such a bad comparison after they started vaccinating. And anyway, there's a very, very bright statistical guy named Matthew Crawford who is digging into this very deeply and who may be able to find out what it was that the military actually did to the data and what the original data, you know, should have been. So that's going on. But we know that there are many more cases of a number of conditions as a result of them revealing this database.
So we don't have much time left. We only have a couple of minutes, but I wanted to ask you what you think is coming down the pike now that this whole thing is falling apart.
Well, we got Ukraine and that, and somehow Ukraine led the powers that be to scare people over nuclear war. You know, and here's the United States that has been basically daring Putin. You know, we've been getting worse and worse, giving them, you know, there are American military officers.
Oh yeah, we're all up in that business.
The Azov battalion.
Our tax dollars are deep into Ukraine.
So we've been, you know, sticking needles at Putin and daring him to do something. And so finally he did. I'm not in favor of what he did, but it wasn't a surprise. It seemed like that's what we wanted. And then the United States said, oh, you know, we're getting close to nuclear war. Why would we be? I mean, the Russians don't want nuclear war any more than we do.
Right.
And probably they've experienced real war. So there's that. And then that led to an excuse for why there wouldn't be enough food, because
Ukraine supplies a lot of food as well as supplying a lot of fertilizer to the world.
Yeah, you mentioned all those warehouses being put on fire.
Lots of warehouses. It's extraordinary. All caught fire, you know, within the same couple of weeks. And a plane landed in one of them. All sorts of things are happening. So I think the food, and then the Union Pacific saying they're not going to carry all the train cars for the United States' largest fertilizer company, and telling them to reduce their shipments of fertilizer by 20% because there's too many cars on the tracks. It's like, what?